On today's BizNews briefing, President Trump is pushing for talks or regime change in Iran. President Ramaphosa seeks to mediate, but Neil de Beer slams his detached stance. Treasury's Ismail Momoniat is optimistic about exiting the Financial Action Task Force's grey list. SACLEC's Russell Lamberti warns that the new Employment Equity Act could choke businesses. And Tesla's Robotaxi hits Austin streets. Stay tuned.
This BizNews briefing is brought to you by Investec Business Banking. Make the move from business as usual to Investec Business Banking.
It's Monday, the 23rd of June. I'm Stuart Lohman. Tensions in the Middle East have spiked after US airstrikes targeted three of Iran's key nuclear facilities. As the world braces for Iran's response, President Donald Trump is doubling down on calls for talks, even hinting at regime change, Bloomberg reports.
A short time ago, the U.S. military carried out massive precision strikes on the three key nuclear facilities in the Iranian regime, Fordo, Natanz, and Esfahan. Everybody heard those names for years as they built this horribly destructive enterprise.
Tyler Kendall at the White House now as the world waits for potential retaliation from Iran. The State Department is now urging increased caution to U.S. citizens abroad. Tyler?
Yeah, hey Joe, good evening. Well, a U.S. official tells us that President Trump has spent today working here at the White House. It is our understanding that he had a phone call with U.K. Prime Minister Keir Starmer a short time ago as the U.S. and its allies are calling for talks to resume over Iran's nuclear program, with President Trump threatening further action if Iran does not come to the negotiating table. But it's something that Iranian officials reiterated today. It cannot happen unless the strikes against them stop first. Now, it is interesting to note that U.S. officials really have maintained that the mission of this operation has been to destroy Iran's nuclear program and its ambitions. But then we got a post from President Trump on Truth Social within the last hour where he used the words regime change, reading in part, quote, "If the current Iranian regime is unable to make Iran great again, why wouldn't there be a regime change?" We should note it's unclear under what circumstances the U.S. would really support this. But looking ahead, we are going to have to consider that as a factor here as we watch how both sides are going to react. Another thing that we're waiting on is that U.S. officials, as well as the International Energy Atomic Agency, do tell us that it is going to take a long time to get that fuller assessment about how much damage actually did happen when it does come to these strikes. But we did hear from Vice President J.D. Vance earlier today in a series of interviews where he said that the U.S. maintains that it did significant damage when it comes to delaying Iran's ambitions for a nuclear weapon. But he did signal that Iran still holds on to a stockpile of enriched uranium.
Well, and of course, as we consider the capabilities Iran may still have at its disposal, Tyler, what risk does that put U.S. troops in the Middle East in now? And what is the White House doing to try to hedge against that risk?
Well, the White House has said that it has been proactive when it comes to protecting our troops. As you well know, we did move personnel out of Iraq last week as one example. But given the fact that there are more than 40,000 troops deployed in theater at the moment, that really does heighten the risk here when it comes to how the U.S. is viewing this picture holistically. We should say, though, that our analysts at Bloomberg do indicate that Iran might temper its response due to a few different factors here, including a weak economy, domestic discontent with the regime, and also the fact that we haven't really seen strategic allies of Iran lend anything more than rhetorical support at the moment, though, of course, we are watching it very closely. But Joe and Kaylee, today, Iran's parliament did vote to close the Strait of Hormuz. Now, that doesn't mean it's going to happen, but that would be, of course, a significant development in this and no doubt would be contributing to the moves that we're seeing when it comes to oil.
As global powers brace for the fallout from those U.S. strikes, South Africa's Cyril Ramaphosa has tried to position himself as a peace broker, but United Independent Movement leader Neil de Beer didn't hold back on this week's Sunday show. De Beer slammed what he sees as Ramaphosa's detachment from reality in a no-punches-pulled exchange.
Right, let's start with President Cyril Ramaphosa telling Israel and Iran to enter into peaceful dialogue, Neil.
Yeah, they immediately reacted. Guns were withdrawn, heavy ammunition stored, papers came out, champagne to the table, and a couple of cookies. quite a lot of toss. I mean, Chris, we really have to start thinking about the options between fact and reality. Now, when you speak to psychologists and people that work with a mind, which still today is probably like the ocean, we still don't know what stuff swim around the deepest sides of the ocean. I equate that as the same as the depth of the person's mind, because I don't know about you and the people that follow us, but I am every day surprised about the absolute craziness that sometimes comes out of a person's mind. I am looking at Cyril Cupcake Ramaphosa, and I'm saying, does this man have a basis of reality? And I'm not insulting him. I'm telling him, on the global scale, Chris, of where South Africa fits in on certain levels. In other words, our influence in the world, the power we wield, in other words, power will then be broken up into, let's say, military power, Borgerol, flat tire, economic power, Borgerol, flat tire, the placing of where we are on influence. We had it when the passport we carried was one of the most influential in the 94 era. Also gone. Vach. And then we get this gentleman that sits and he's the master over a country that still has a grey listing over it because our fiscal policies aren't right. Our military is in collapse, and we are definitely going to touch on it because it doesn't seem to sink in there as well. Our joblessness, our labor disputes, our basic incredible implosion laws, all of that. And Cupcake still gets up with a twinkling in his eyes and says, he can sort out world peace. My day small. You can't even sort out the current problems that we've got in this country on race, economy, safety and security, and just basic understanding of running a country. And the evidence to that is you've called for a national dialogue to so-called reset our country, but you want to go and tell Russia, tell Ukraine, tell Israel, tell Hamas, tell Hezbollah, tell Tehran, and America that you demand that they get back to the table. Well, Chris, I'm not going to say it, but our thousands, the more than 250,000 people a week that look at us are all going to surely go, what are you on about? And I think it's becoming a joke now that we think that our interventions on a global scale is actually going to be heeded when the fingers are pointing back at us to say, why don't you go sort out the murders on the Cape Flats that are horrific and that are at times sometimes worse than the deaths in four or five current military operations in the world?
You can find the full interview on BizNews TV on YouTube. In a rare moment of financial redemption, Treasury veteran Ishmael Momoniat explained how that after 2 years of hard reform, South Africa is now on track to exit the Financial Action Task Force's grey list.
I think that it was a clear result of state capture and the weakening of our institutions. And if you recall, even in 2015-16, we tried to get the FICA amendment bill, and President Zuma, in fact, had great objections over that bill. Firstly, it got delayed through the cabinet process for a year, and even when it went through to parliament, and when he had to sign it into law, he referred it back to parliament. He claimed that there were constitutional deficiencies. But you know, we were able to address whatever concerns. But there was big resistance to the concept of politically exposed persons being formalized in that book. In fact, we had to change it to, I think it was politically influential persons. So, there was resistance, and that's just an example of the resistance. And so when we had our mutual evaluation, which is the peer review that the Financial Action Task Force, or FATF, does every 7 or 8 years, we are one of 40 members currently, but they do it to all countries that want to be part of the financial system, which, as you know, is globally integrated. So whether you're in FATF or not, you want to go through a mutual evaluation. And when we went through that mutual evaluation, we were found to be deficient on what the FATF does is it looks at two measures. Firstly, on the legal framework. FATF has 40 standards, what it calls 40 recommendations, and we were found deficient in 20 of the 40. So we had to make adjustments to our legislative framework. And then on effectiveness, which dealt with implementation, it won't surprise you to know that that's always the challenge, as we know, in our country. And we fail on all 11 measures. We got what was called a moderate rating, which is a fail, like getting 30%. And then we, on the other 8, we failed miserably. So, you know, we failed all 11 what's called immediate outcomes, but those were the effectiveness measures. So we kind of failed so badly that we were then put into a 1-year observation period, where we were able to bring together two major amendment laws, which, by the way, has helped us greatly, but we were still found wanting on implementation. And that's what we had to then deal with. And on implementation, I think it was, I think we got there directly as a result of state capture, of the reluctance of the former president and cabinet at the time to update our laws, because FATF requires you to continually update to any changes in their standards. You know, we had one, a mutual evaluation in 2010, and we did fine on that one, but we didn't update our laws. And secondly, on effectiveness, remember, you know, state capture was about the deliberate weakening of the police, of the Hawks, or the DPCI, of the National Prosecuting Authority, of SARS, and many of our institutions. So we were actually lousy preventing and implementing, or preventing and enforcing the laws that applied, and to deal with financial crimes.
At Sun Exchange, we make going solar simple, profitable, and completely risk-free. Join over 100 satisfied South African customers already enjoying the benefits of risk-free solar. Start saving today. Visit sunexchange.com and join the solar revolution.
SAKELIGE's Russell Lamberti warns that the newly amended Employment Equity Act imposes rigid race, gender, and disability quotas that threaten to cripple businesses, increase unemployment, and chase away investment. He calls on South African business leaders to resist.
The South African government has given thousands of businesses a choice. Apply its new race-based hiring quotas, or be fined and prosecuted. The latest employment equity regulations for the first time establish explicit employment quotas. Employers are classified into 18 industries, each split into 4 employment tiers. Each of these 72 categories is then assigned specific quotas for race, gender, and disability. From September 2025, employers have 5 years to fully comply, but risk fines every year for slow progress. Now, what would be the impact of such extreme social engineering? Well, put simply, endless absurdities. Think, for example, of roles overwhelmingly preferred by women, like nursing and childcare. or by men like trucking and construction. In these cases, the roughly 50% quotas for gender are clearly impossible to meet. But the racial quotas are even more far-fetched. They restrict white males to just 4% in many categories, and most not much higher. In agriculture, top management is generously capped at 66%. But this still sends a message to the farmer that his son shouldn't have a career in the family business. While this amounts to targeted economic sanctions against white men and their families, the axe could fall on anyone if their particular demographic group happens to be overrepresented in an organization. And with such a significant increase in the regulatory burden at the 50 staff threshold, might companies with 49 employees decide more hiring just isn't worth the trouble? Wouldn't those with, say, 53 staff contemplate the considerable regulatory relief from laying off just 4 staff members? Moreover, the state can and likely will shift the goalposts, a common practice in its race-based policies. The quotas would certainly be made more onerous over time, and the applicable employment threshold could be lowered from 50 to, say, 30, 20, or even 10. Sanctions and fines could easily escalate beyond the already debilitating 10% of turnover. Even before the latest regulations, South Africa's inflexible employment laws were a major contributor to persistently low economic growth and high unemployment. The new regulations now completely disregard the realities of skills, kinship, language, culture, relationships, geography, and so much else that influences employment in the real world. These rigid demographic quotas are business and job killers for everyone. Their economic and social toll would be catastrophic. So, should we really either comply with new race-based employment quotas or risk crippling fines and prosecutions? No. This is an unacceptable choice. Responsible business people must oppose the Employment Equity Act. Here's how. First, we can expect widespread non-cooperation with these impossible requirements by ethical businesses as they inevitably prioritize their real-world obligations to staff, customers, and shareholders. Second, foreign companies, to whom the Act and quotas also apply, should and will escalate their concerns with their respective embassies. Third, Saakliche and others are litigating to oppose these regulations on constitutional and practical grounds, and it is crucial that business people support these legal efforts. With resolute opposition and ethical, appropriate non-cooperation, we can resist these employment quotas and protect our businesses, our employees, and all communities across the country.
From boardroom battles to driverless vehicles, Tesla has officially launched its robotaxi service in Austin, Texas, with no one behind the wheel. The pilot is small, but marks a significant milestone in self-driving tech, courtesy of DP Cars.
Tesla just launched its robotaxi service today, and the automotive world is buzzing. The pilot program kicked off in Austin, Texas, where a small fleet of Tesla Model Y vehicles, equipped with Tesla's full self-driving technology, started taking real passengers on real trips. This is not a test simulation or a distant concept. Tesla robo-taxis are live, on the road, and carrying people across a geofenced area in South Austin. The rollout is limited for now. Only about 10 to 20 vehicles are in service, and the rides are currently available to a select group of early users, including influencers and investors. While these vehicles are just standard Model Y crossovers for now, the future of the service points toward Tesla's purpose-built robo-taxi, often referred to as the Cybercab. That model will have no pedals and no steering wheel and is expected to hit production sometime in 2026. The rides so far have been described as smooth and mostly reliable. Users reported a few minor issues with app access and pickup clarity, but no major technical problems. With companies like Waymo already offering autonomous rides in larger volumes, Tesla is entering a competitive market. But with its massive fan base, tight integration with its cars and ambitious software goals, it is going to be a major player.
This reality might be a long way off for South Africans. And that's it for today's show. A big thanks to the BizNews production team. From me, Stuart Lohman. Until next time.
This BizNews briefing is brought to you by Investec Business Banking. Make the move to private banking service now for your business.